This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. The shaky economy has led to cutbacks in government at all levels, from the federal budget all the way down to the city of Murray. The city's finance committee is currently considering cuts for various community groups, including Murray Main Street and Playhouse in the Park. Shelley Baskin reports on what form the cuts could take and what they would mean for the affected groups.
In a meeting this week, Murray Mayor Bill Wells proposed completely gutting various special appropriations from the city's 2012-13 budget. The drastic step would help fill a $500,000 gap for next year, caused by increased expenses and declining revenues. Half a dozen projects receive special appropriation funding, including Murray Main Street. MMS Director Dina Wright says city funding is an important part of their budget.
They've given us about a quarter of our budget, with our understanding that we had to come up with the rest of it either through fundraising or membership or donations or whatever we do to bring that number up to what we need to have a budget that is viable to accomplish the goals that we have to accomplish.
Wright says the goal of MMS is to preserve and support the historic aspects of downtown, but she says some people have raised concerns about the funding MMS receives from the city because they think it's an unfair advantage for downtown business owners at the expense of people farther out in the city. Wright says that's not the case.
Most of what we do is for the building owners, except we do bring people downtown, and what the business owners down here do with the thousands of people that we bring downtown is up to them.
Wright says it's important for them to continue to receive city funding, not just because they need the money for their projects, but because they also need the money to remain accredited.
One of the things that's important for the Main Street program is to show financial commitment from the city. That's the way we remain certified with the state and the national Main Street programs. And if we don't have that, then that's a red flag to them, and it could mean that we are no longer a certified Main Street program.
Councilman and Finance Committee member Jay Morgan says the city has been looking at ways to keep funding these programs, but the economy has slowed income for the city, just as it has for city residents. He says the city has tried several ways of raising money, including removing the student exemption for buying a city car sticker.
It was decided upon by the council to do so, to raise money, and I anticipate, or at least the mayor's office anticipates, that it will raise an extra $100,000 or so for the city budget.
Morgan says while the city stickers will help fill some gaps in the budget, he doesn't think they will raise as much money as has been projected. He said, though, the mayor's proposal to gut the programs isn't the only option to make up the shortfall. The finance committee proposed a 5% cut.
I think the special appropriations for the agencies, such as Playhouse and Murray Art Guild and the others, is probably okay. I think they'll be funded. I don't see a change in that other than the 5% cut.
Morgan says other planned cuts are to the city firefighter and police pension fund, though the specifics and legality of those cuts are still being considered and debated. But he said any cuts and changes that occur could be reversed when things look better.
I don't think this is something that will last for years and years. I just think over the next year or two, we've got to get our budget deficit down, and I think first and foremost, we've got to learn to live within our means.
But Morgan says until the budget outlook improves, local groups like Murray Main Street will have to tighten their belts. For WKMS News, I'm Shelley Baskin.
As we've just heard, the city of Murray faces an all-too-common problem these days, a steady demand for services while facing the necessity of budget cuts. For other communities in the country, the outlook isn't quite so grim, and what they've done or not done could be instructive. So we looked for a city similar to Murray and came up with Oxford, Mississippi, home of the University of Mississippi. Both cover 10 square miles. They were incorporated within 7 years of each other, and both are located in counties south of another county named Marshall. Oxford's population is just 1,000 higher, and both Oxford and Murray sit at about the same height above sea level. But there are differences. While Murray wrangles with the budget gap, Oxford is booming. Tourism there is on the rise, and their unemployment rate is 1 1/3 points below the national average and falling. By contrast, Murray's unemployment rate is half a point below the U.S. average. What is Oxford doing right, and what could Murray learn from its Mississippi doppelganger? To find out, I spoke with Oxford Mayor George Patterson. I'll begin by asking how Oxford, Mississippi has weathered the recent economy.
Well, we were affected like everybody else, Todd, but I think when the country booms, we maybe don't quite boom as much, and when there's a down cycle, we don't go down nearly as badly. So we weathered it very well. As a city, we kind of kept our heads down. We kept our spending under control, and we didn't expose ourselves. We did not have to raise taxes, and we didn't lay anybody off. But we were very conservative about our capital purchases. We're overbuilt a little bit. We have some condominiums that are still on the market. But as compared to some of the rest of the country, we did very well. Since 2007-08, we have been very conservative with our spending. It's paid off in the fact that we haven't raised taxes and we haven't laid a single employee off. We're in good shape financially. Now, was it all my plan? Absolutely not. I work with a great board, and we saw it together the same way. And, you know, we were able to, from a financial point, be successful.
Could you give us a snapshot of what Oxford was like when you became mayor in 2009?
My predecessor, Richard Horth, had been an excellent mayor. He really did a lot of progressive things. But like every other administration in this country, we were handed an economy that was on the fritz. We lost one of our major manufacturing plants, Whirlpool, and that was 350 jobs. And so one of our early focuses was to get those jobs replaced, which we were fortunate to do. Olin Winchester came to town and actually brought 1,000 jobs with them when they get fully ramped up. And I don't want to say we're out of the woods, but we're certainly better off than a lot of places. I'll say that.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about the tourism situation, because Oxford is the home of Roanoke, the home of William Faulkner. Old Miss is obviously a very big tourist draw. You seem to have experienced something of a shot in the arm as far as tourism is concerned.
Well, we focus on that, Todd. That's one of the things we do. We have a tourism council, very active tourism council. We have a 2% food and beverage tax that we add to all prepared food and all alcoholic beverages that go straight in the tourism council. They're able to do some great things. This past weekend, we had a Double Ducker Festival. It's kind of our signature festival that attracted 55,000 people. Worked closely with the university. This is the smallest Division I host school in the United States. So, you know, we have to work closely with the university. And we have a very good relationship there. And they give us a heads up when they with their advanced planning, and we try and do the same back for them. It's a group effort of the Board of Aldermen and myself. And we try and spend what we take in, zero-sum budgeting. And we've been successful with it. We have been.
Well, let me ask you a bit of a hypothetical question. If you were running a school for mayors, is there any great lesson that you've drawn from your time so far as Oxford mayor that you could impart to other mayors?
Local government is for service. You know, now, I'm not saying state governments aren't, and I'm not saying federal governments aren't, but local governments are for service. If you need something, if you got a pothole, if the sewer doesn't work, if there's the neighbors are creating a problem, you know, that's my view of local government, is serve the people of your community. So I preach that day in and day out to our staff and everybody else. Look, we work for the people of this town, and if they've got a problem, we need to try and go help them with it. So that's our philosophy of government.
And another hypothetical, when something comes up like that, say, for instance, there is some sort of, God forbid, a natural disaster, a tornado or something along those lines, how could the city really absorb that additional expense?
Depends on the magnitude of the disaster. If we have an F5 tornado, we're going to look for help from anybody we can, state, federal, anybody else. We have a reserve, and we treat it as a trust fund. It's from the sale of our hospital, that's $30 million. We hope it generates about $1 million a year, and we use that as, you know, for special projects and needs for the community. So are we able to handle minor things ourselves? I would like to think yes. Are we able to handle a major disaster? No, we would ask MEMA and FEMA for help. I think as government, you can spend anything you take in and more. Mm-hmm. So we have to prioritize. You have to, you know, if you've got 5 streets that need to be resurfaced, then you pick 2 this year and 3 next year. You know, you don't go into debt to try and do the whole thing at one time. if I'm a moderate on some of our social programs, I'm a very conservative person on government finances.
George Patterson is mayor of Oxford, Mississippi. Mayor Patterson, thanks for talking to us today.
Sure, I'm glad to.
Hello, city. Hey, another night at the palace, 'cause there is nothing else to do. Oh, oh. The same people, the same drinks and the same music, the same quicksand. I think this harbor town is waist deep and singing fast. Hello city,
hello city, hello city, hey.
Coming up, we look into our up and down temperatures and the lack of rain, plus taking advantage of a little known Kentucky tax credit. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
From the liquor room up to the change room to the doom and gloom of the hotel room, I think this seaside beer hall should sink into the bay.
This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Not long ago, there was an eye-opening report about the transfer of wealth that aging baby boomers would create, and the nonprofits took note. Next week, there is an educational program in Murray about the latest trends in philanthropy and how to harness them to enrich the quality of life in our area for generations to come. Kate Lochte has more.
Two donors, each giving $25,000 unrestricted seed money to the Murray Calloway Community Foundation, got the ball rolling for its goal of helping local nonprofits. Murray attorney Harold Hurt is board chair for the MCC Foundation, which is affiliated with the Community Foundation of West Kentucky. That foundation's director, Tony Watkins, is among speakers for the May 8th program called Philanthropy 360 Degrees. Mr. Hurt says Watkins and others serving on the Endow Kentucky Commission paved the way for philanthropy in the Commonwealth.
Tony Watkins will be talking to the group about the Kentucky tax credit. He was involved in the formation of that statute, which gives persons who make endowed gifts to a community foundation eligible for a Kentucky tax credit of up to 20% or at 20% of the first $50,000 of the gift. And by the way, that statute passed both the House and the Senate in the state of Kentucky unanimously, if you can believe it. It basically creates $500,000 a year in tax credit. It runs on the fiscal year for the state of Kentucky, so we're coming up on the end of the first year, June 30. And to this point, there's still over $100,000 of this tax credit available. And to this point, the Murray-Calloway County Community Foundation has taken advantage of this tax credit more than any other community foundation in the state of Kentucky.
The principal speaker for Philanthropy 360 Degrees on May 8th is Murray State's visiting distinguished professor of nonprofit leadership, previously of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, Dr. Bob Long. Dr. Long's mentoring has helped the Murray-Calloway Community Foundation, as well as many other entities across the state and the nation, adopt best practices in building financially stable helping organizations. Mr. Hurt.
He recommended that we talk to some community foundations in other cities and other states and communities our size that also had universities. And so he, with all his contacts, arranged for three interviews. Our whole board interviewed the executive directors of these three community foundations in counties with populations very similar to Calloway County, and all of those cities had universities. And we learned all the do's and don'ts. We did all of that before we ever even started. We spent over a year in organizing our community foundation before we ever started to raise any funds.
The Murray-Calloway Community Foundation just closed applications for its first round of building its endowed funds. Mr. Hurt explains how.
We decided we need to try to educate our local charities that endowed funds are the way of the future. Now, it's a long-range future, but at least it's the way of the future. So we took the $50,000 gifts that we had, and we then allocated $2,500 that we would match of any local charity that would set up an endowed fund the first $2,500 that they put into their endowed fund. And we now have applications from 11 local charities and nonprofit groups, including the Murray Independent School District, that have applied, and we are now matching funds. Some of them are putting in $2,500. We've had a couple that put in $10,000. So we're actually basically taking this $50,000 gift, and it's going to be worth, you know, probably $125,000 or $30,000 in endowed funds for the future of Callaway County.
In addition to Dr. Bob Long and Tony Watkins, the Murray-Callaway Community Foundation's program, Philanthropy 360 Degrees, Tuesday, May 8th, features Reggie LeGrand of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and Mr. Hurt. There's a meet and greet at 5. The program runs from 5:30 to 6:30, and everyone's welcome at Rather Museum, North 16th and University Drive on the Murray campus. For WKMS News, I'm Kate Lochte.
Are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.
La Niña is over, according to the National Weather Service. The weather pattern based on Central Pacific Ocean temperatures has been to blame for some of the unseasonable weather we've had over the course of a few years. We've gone from the wettest April on record in 2011 to a very dry April this year. To discuss some of our weather pattern oddities, Chad Lampe spoke with Warning Coordination Meteorologist Rick Shanklin of the National Weather Service.
Let's talk about some of the current weather that we're experiencing with some, I don't know if you'd call them dramatically warmer temperatures, but near record highs at least.
Yeah, you know, it has been a very warm spring, really from late winter into the spring. March was unusually warm, almost more typical of a May or at least late April. And then again, we've warmed up here again recently with high pressure building across the eastern half of the United States. And with us being under that ridge, it's allowed temperatures to really spike up.
What's the history here for our region? The weather, again, we had a mild winter. We have a very warm set of temperatures this week. And then we're coming off of a bit of a cold snap in April. It feels like it's been up and down.
Yeah, it really has. You know, we got some of that cooler air filtered down from Canada last week. And actually, we're looking at our 6 to 10 and 8 to 14 day outlooks, which call for below normal temperatures. So we may see a swing back down in that direction again here after another week or so of well above normal temperatures.
What precedents do we have for these swings?
You know, it's hard to say. We've been in the La Niña pattern, and that has to do with the ocean temperatures in the equatorial Pacific, and those are kind of neutralizing. We're going into more of a neutral phase, so there are other things that come into play that really can cause the swings. You know, we look at the jet stream, and certainly if it dips down out of Canada toward us, that's when we get the cooler temperatures, and that's when we can also get stormier patterns, and that's possible as we make the transition once again from these above normal temperatures to cooler than normal temperatures here in another week or so. We may see an increased stormy pattern.
Has it been an unusually quiet spring for severe weather?
It has been just like the temperatures, so has the storm activity been up and down greatly. We started out with the greatest number of tornadoes in our region on record through the month of March. In April, which is one of our two busiest months of the year for tornado activity, we only saw one tornado, and that was in early April. And of course, we were well below normal rainfall in April. In fact, for many areas, the driest April on record, in contrast to the wettest April on record a year ago. And so without any storm activity, of course, that keeps the tornado activity nil as well. So just some major ups and downs, both in temperatures and precipitation and storm activity.
Let's talk about the usage of weather radios. We talk about this consistently when there are storm warnings that come over our airwaves regarding the usage of local weather radios. But you found that a lot of people are, in some cases, unplugging their weather radios?
Yes, we have. One of the tornadoes that hit earlier this year hit in the Evansville area, Newburg, Indiana, and there was a survey done of 28 people that had weather radios. 15 of the 28, through the course of the winter or before that even, had unplugged their weather radios. And the key thing that they saw is it going off too much. But when we do a little digging into those people that have those weather radios, what we typically find is they've got 3, 4, 5, maybe more counties programmed into their unit. And most all of the weather radios, if they are SAME equipped, means you can program it for whichever county or counties you want to. So what we are encouraging now is for people to only program one county in their weather radio, at the very most maybe one additional county. And even if you're close to the county line, you know, the warnings are storm-based now versus county-based, so chances are you're going to get plenty of advanced notification, even if you have just one county programmed in.
Also, there are certain weather radios on the market that allow you to select which warnings you'd like to be notified of, right?
Yeah, and so if that's still a problem for you and you just, you know, really don't want it to go off, for example, except for tornado warnings, the most extreme type of events, you can buy a higher-end model that is programmable by event, and that's the key thing. It's programmable by event. And you can program out, for example, if you didn't want severe thunderstorm watches programmed in, you could program that out. If you didn't want flood warnings in there, you can program that out. You know, you could tailor it down almost to just tornado warnings, and of course then it would hardly ever go off, but it would go off for the most critical thing of all.
Well, warning coordination meteorologist Rick Shanklin with the National Weather Service, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
May 12th, Marshall County High School's Kenneth Shadow and Performing Arts Center is the site of a fundraiser for the Marshall County Arts Commission's latest project. Kate Lochte has details.
Out of town for 3 days, when I hit the door, kids run into my arms as I kneel on the floor. Saying something about a puppy and some kid at the pool, and something about something that somebody did at school. Something whispers inside me, breathe deep, breathe deep.
That's the title track of Christian music's megastar vocalist Guy Penrod's Breathe Deep, his inaugural solo project. Mr. Penrod performs a benefit Saturday, May 12th in Benton for the Marshall County Arts Commission. Its immediate past president, George Milam, says the commission hopes proceeds from Mr. Penrod's performance at the Kenneth Shadowin Performing Arts Center will help match a grant for the construction of a place for visual arts instruction to complement the commission's present programming.
We've got a performing children's chorus made up of students in the school system and homeschool, and also the community Christian school of students in grades 3 through 8. And we also have a children's theater that is up and running and very popular, and it involves those same age group. Our children's chorus is being directed by Dr. Bradley Almquist of Murray State University. He comes over once a week, and he is working with our children and has been for, oh, 2 or 3 years.
The commission has $20 tickets for the Guy Penrod concert at its website, marshallcountyarts.com. Mr. Penrod and his wife homeschool their 8 children, and their careers intermingle. Angie Penrod provides vocals to this track off the artist's new Breathe Deep album.
Someday I'll slow down a little, you might even slow down too. But as long as this old heart's still beating, I'll be loving you. That'll never get old, that'll never get old, even when we do.
So I wanted to take a Christian worldview or a biblical worldview and wrap it in as everyday a language as I could to answer a lot of the questions, challenges that we as humans face, maybe temptations or struggles, opportunities. And I like country music, so I put country feels and music around those particular songs and that subject matter, and wanted to put it out in the marketplace to hopefully affect those who are looking and searching for answers and truth and say, no, give this a shot.
Mr. Penrod says his performance for the Marshall County Arts Commission will include a sampling of his 14 years singing as centerpiece of Bill Gaither's vocal band, selections from Breathe Deep, and songs from his latest released hymn. I asked Mr. Penrod about vocalists whom he most admires, and he mentions an artist with whom he recorded a duet for him.
He was the soloist that sang prior to Dr. Billy Graham speaking at all of his crusades. His name is George Beverly Shea. Just a rich, deep baritone voice, a Canadian-born gentleman, that just a striking-looking man, very commanding.
So he's still that
kid.
Way.
Yes, he is. Now, he's 103, so, you know, time takes its toll on our bodies. But I took a team of technicians and guys that know how to record up to his home in North Carolina, and we recorded him. And still at 103, he walks around, uses a little cane to walk with, but he's in good health. His mind is vibrant and alive, and he still sang so beautifully a hymn called Does Jesus Care on that record with me, a real highlight in my career.
The Marshall County Arts Commission believes that Guy Penrod's drawing power will attract a large audience and raise matching funds for the construction of this Children's Arts Center to be built in downtown Benton. Again, Commission spokesperson George Milam.
With the programs that we were already doing with the families in our community, we were able to qualify, so the city of Benton is applied for this grant on our behalf, and quite frankly, we were very fortunate to get it. We were one of 8 throughout the state that was awarded the $500,000 grant. So we have to come up with some matching funds to take this project to the level that it needs to be to serve the boys and girls in the community.
Gaither recording artist, Abilene, Texas-born Guy Penrod laughed when I told him that George Milam said to me, "Tell Guy Penrod we're going to treat him right." Penrod knows about our region.
My father was the youngest of 12, and he was born and raised right across the border north of you in Harrisburg, Illinois. And most of his clan stayed around there. He moved out west, which is why I was born out in Texas, obviously, and raised us out that direction. But we always came back to the southern Illinois, Paducah, Reedland, Kentucky, Kentucky Lake area, and vacationed with our family. A lot of fish fries in the Massac County Park. And so when we moved to Tennessee and started having kids, we had to find a spot up around the lake and use that for recharging your batteries and making great memories on the water and with your relatives, you know. So, yeah, we spend a good portion of our summertime up in that area.
We close with a bit of Guy Penrod's rendition of Softly and Tenderly from his new release, Hymn. For Front Page, I'm Kate Lochte.
Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling for you. Thank you.
Next, a chat with retiring State Senator Ken Winters. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
Watching for you and for me. Come home. Come home.
I'm Todd Hatton, and you're listening to Front Page Sunday.
And I'm Chad Lampe. First District State Senator Ken Winters finished his last regular session of his legislative career last month. Winters is a lifelong educator and has served as a dean of the College of Industry and Technology at Murray State and president of Campbellsville University. He spent 8 years in the Kentucky Senate, making significant headway in the Commonwealth's education policy, and he joins me today to talk about this past session and his legacy in the Kentucky legislature. So you've had a direct impact on 8 of 33 Senate bills that became law this session. Those bills you either sponsored or that went through the Senate Education Committee, which you chair.
Right.
So which bill are you most proud of that you had an impact on this session?
One bill that comes to mind is, and it comes to mind because we spent roughly 2 years, the governor established this Transforming Education in Kentucky Task Force 2 years ago. And as a result of that, I served on that task force. And as a result of it, one of the recommendations involved trying to pull together the career and technical programs that 54 or so of the schools are assigned to workforce development, not Kentucky Department of Education. And then about 16 of them are controlled or managed by local school districts. And those were separate, and even the curricula was not common in some of those programs. So as a result of that Transforming Education in Kentucky Task Force, there was a recommendation that they pull together another work group to look at career and technical ed. And we did that at several meetings, had several subgroups working on that, and we brought forth a recommendation that was organizationally a little different than Senator Westwood's bill on career pathways. But both of those came along during this session. And actually, one of the things we did do is the locally controlled school came to be locally controlled because the local officials in that particular district petitioned to have that school that was heretofore under the workforce development transferred to them. And that happened, well, at least there's 16 of them like that. But there wasn't the reciprocal opportunity for the schools to move from one. So we did get that component into the in budget language this time that would allow that to happen. But in a nutshell, the Career Pathways Bill takes into account that there are many people that may not want to go to college. There are many people that get frustrated, get disenfranchised, whatever, however you want to describe it. And this bill will try to capture them the minute we realize they're at risk. And we began to put career counselors with them and nurture them and try to keep them on track. And it happens to be my belief that that's the way you prevent dropouts.
Also, Senate Bill 95 related to summer learning camps, yeah, and essentially, was the impetus to help reduce achievement gaps.
It is, and reduce that summer gap in their recollection of what they've learned too. So there's a significant decrease in a student's ability coming back in the fall from where they left the system back in the spring. This is funded with Title I money, which is the money is available to do this, and they would then be allowed, especially if they're on free or reduced lunch, and others if they want to chip in and help pay a little for it too. But they can come in during the summer and have special teachers to deal with math and some of the areas that they feel like they need some emphasis in. And it goes beyond that to helping with their socialization, with athletic activities and various things. So the summer learning camp is one that, you know, a lot of bills we do not succeed the first time we bring them out of the chute, but this one was the second time we've done that bill, and this time it really gained in support. It can make a big difference in a young person because, you know, they come back in, they forgot a lot of things, and I don't know about you, but I forget a lot of things, too. So when I come back in the fall and I'm a little bit short on my recollection, then I'm going to struggle for a while. that may set the stage for me to begin thinking about dropping out at upper ages.
How does this work? Are school districts funded to offer these summer camps? Are they required to offer these summer learning camps?
No. It's strictly a volunteer program, and they qualify by the percentage of their students are on free and reduced lunch, and then that qualifies them to use Title I money to help fund that. But other students, as I pointed out, other students could participate if the parents wanted to help underwrite the cost of it.
Let's talk about something not necessarily education-oriented, the slow-moving vehicle sign that you are behind and push that through.
There are people all over the state that, for religious beliefs do not will not accept the use of that. And so when the word got out that I was interested in this, and I worked with the ones over here and the ones up in Logan County, And I had people from all over the nation that were contacting me and saying, thank you for taking this on, and here are some resources you might want to look at. And so I looked at every state that have made such accommodations, primarily Illinois and Wisconsin and Ohio and a few other states. And I went through and made a list of things that they had used. And then I had numerous sessions with the people over in Graves. And then we came up with what I think was an absolute improvement on the safety issue. It accommodates their religious beliefs, too. And I made a comment in the committee that it will not be abnormal a decade or two decades from now. Some of the religious beliefs that one of us has may be challenged. And I'm hoping that others will take up our case and help us weather that kind of storm. And this one does for them. But I had to be, in my own mind, comfortable that what we're doing to them not only creates a safer environment for them, but it creates a safer environment for all of us that drive the roads with them. Because there's nothing that would hurt me more than run over one of those buggies. And you come over a hill and the triangle is down at the bottom of it, and you're right on top of it by the time you see that thing there. But when you look at the configuration we have with tape and lamps, and not only on the back of it, but on the sides and on the front, so that you can, if you're coming toward it, you know where the vehicle's at in relationship to the road. So it is by far a safer one. And a lady that lives near them over in Graves County, I told them I needed some photographs. Before the session started, they had two buggies rigged like the ones that I describe in the bill. And I said, I want photos up close at 200 feet, 400, 600, and 1,000 feet away. And I want sitting there with a buggy with a triangle on it and show them all the way to comparison of the two all the way out to 1,000 feet. And those photographs instantly sold the bill.
Would you consider this past session successful for you in the state Senate?
I would. And one thing that the governor had signed another bill, Senate Bill 213, was a bill that helps foster children. And I had some people that work with them and a number of the young people that are about to leave the foster care. And like it is now, they might come in and say, on the day before their 18th birthday, and say, are you ready? Are you going to recommit to us? Or are you going out on your own? Well, I began to think myself, if Mom and Dad had set two suitcases out on the front porch when I was 18 and then said, good luck to you, stay in touch with us, I'm not sure how prepared I would be. And therefore, they don't need to have to make that decision without a period of orientation and counseling and preparing them to make that. And then we said a recommittal. That sounds like you're going to an institution.
Mm-hmm.
So we call it expansion of transitional living. And so this bill, I think, is one that will have a great impact on young people in foster care as they leave or as they decide not to leave and stay in the program and let us as a state help them through an educational experience. And some of the young people that testified for us won the hearts of everyone there. So that was a major bill, simple bill, but yet it had an emotional side to it that everyone was excited about.
You've spent 8 years in the Kentucky Senate. Can you hang your hat on one piece of legislation that you think will be your legacy in the Senate?
Well, I suspect probably be Senate Bill 1, but it was a bold step, and it related to how we assess young people at the end of each year and how we use that assessment in their accountability. And everyone was worried about how much time we spend in assessing and how early it was in the semester before graduation. And this one, it develops new core content for the areas that are a little narrower than the ones before but are deeper, so that we build basic skills. And the other issue is we don't have much that the student is held responsible for in the old CATS testing system. We were evaluating schools, not students. And naturally, the school's rating will be based on how the students do, but there was virtually no way for us to track student-specific data at the student level and track them and going forward. And I made a comment to the state school board one time. I said, you know, you may not believe this, but as a university president, I've never admitted a high school to college. And some of them grinned because they knew where I was going, and the others, a few of them did not, because I'd gone a little bit beyond how they had thought about it. But I said, I know it's important for you to know how, and I use this example, how Pikeville High School and Paducah-Tillman High School compare. But at the university, it doesn't matter to me. I'm interested in how Johnny and Mary have progressed from the time they started in the school and as they come upward. If I'm going to put together a financial package to attract a young person, I need for them to have had some skin in the game as they moved along. So I'm proud of that bill, and I do believe that in the long haul it will make the difference in young people's lives.
Was there anything that you regret not having passed? Like, if you could pick, you know, you have your best accomplishment, what's the best thing that didn't get accomplished that you really wish would have?
Well, there's several things I could talk about there, but one thing that I've always wanted, everything I can do to entice a young person to work aggressively and work hard, but to help them make a decision very quickly to go on into post-secondary education of some kind, whether it's a technical school or whatever. This year I had my early graduation bill. This is the third year that we've had it. And what it does is that, or would have done, it did not get approved at the last minute. We thought it was going to, but it establishes an 18-hour requirement, which includes AP courses or international baccalaureate courses, and it requires foreign language courses, it requires 4 mathematics and 4 English, but yet they do it in 3 years. The young person and their parents agree that as they enter high school that they would like to participate in the early graduation program, and you'll see just in a moment why they would be interested, other than just showing their capability. But if they elect to do that, then some of them, and some of them already are, taking high school algebra in the eighth grade, an English class in the eighth grade, a freshman English class. So some of them would need to do that in this program. But they then graduate at the end of their junior year. The number would probably be fairly small, but what it does, it allows them to leave, and the school district, just like a dropout, they've now left the school, and therefore the SEEK formula that would have been coming to the school to support them as a senior doesn't exist anymore. What happened to it? It went into a trust fund that then, if they go immediately into post-secondary ed, go to the university or a career and technical school, it would move with them and pay basically the cost of their tuition for their first year. But they can't wait a year to do it. They have to do it the very first year out. So it's one that truly I would love to have seen. I have to tell you that I won't, because I won't be up there, I won't neglect to have some input on some of these that we didn't get done.
Who do you think might succeed you as the chair of the Education Committee?
Well, naturally, it won't be a decision for me to make, but there's at least, you know, I'm thinking of at least two people that are already on the committee that are dynamic people, and I wouldn't prejudice by naming them, but we have two people already. One of them just emailed me to say, what are the dates of the summer interim joint committee meetings from June through November? And I want to make sure I'm trying to plan a little trip, but I don't want to miss one of the education committee. So he has that kind of commitment to it. And another person from up in Central Kentucky is a dynamic person. Either one of them could do a good job with it. They don't bring 38 years
of experience, like
education
you.
experience, but they are absolutely committed to doing what's right for young people in Kentucky.
Well, let's say that after January 1, you're completely out of the fray of politics. You don't really have to worry about partisanship, per se. Can you opine a bit on the future of stiff partisanship in our legislature, strictly between the House and the Senate, and how it's been very partisan over the last at least 8 years?
Yeah, and it seems to get a little more complex as we go along, too. I guess anytime you have strong personalities—
Do you think that the representative speaker of the House and the president of the Senate, when they speak, do you think they speak for the chamber, or do you think that they speak for their party within the chamber?
I'd say quite often the bulk of their speaking is related to their caucus within the chamber. Naturally, that may change from time to time. In fairness to both leaders of the two chambers, I think. They want to do what's right. And my mother always taught me two things for all my life. Now, remember your words about all you have. Now, the quickest way to destroy a relationship between those two leaders is for one of them to renege on a statement. Because I have to know, if it's somebody on my committee, if you say this to me today, I expect it to be similar to what you tell me tomorrow. We have to be straightforward and upfront and consistent and honest in the way we deal with the issue. So I think both of them would like to do that kind of role, and maybe they will become a little easier next time.
So you've endorsed Trigg County Judge Executive Stan Humphreys to fill your seat in the Senate,
right,
and he'll face Carol Hubbard, who you faced last time that you ran. Are you confident that Stan Humphreys can win this race?
I am. Naturally, even if I'm running again, you don't take anything for granted. It doesn't matter how much you think you're going to win by. You have to give it every ounce of your energy. And my first time 8 years ago, when I made a decision to do it in November, then I went at it aggressively from then up till, and here comes the primary along, and I've been going at it just like I had a primary opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And some people got kind of offended when they went down to vote in the primary and found out I'm not even on there. But the issue is that Stan Humphrey is an outstanding fella. He's two-term judge executive over there, and you've seen him on the media as it relates to the bridge incident and mm-hmm. everything else. So he's on top of it. He's a farmer by background. A lot of people call me about him, and many of them will say, and I'll start, he's a two-term judge executive, and et cetera. And they say, but do you support him? That's the question I have. And I say, absolutely do. He's the kind of person that will represent us in a magnificent way. He probably wind up being on agriculture or on state and local government committee as his primary interest level when he gets there. But it's not what his specialty is and what his interests are. It's what kind of person is he? Can we trust him with the future of our Senate district? And that's where I feel he brings so much to the table.
Well, Senator Ken Winters, retiring State Senator Ken Winters, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for being with us.